Grace to you and welcome to the Deeper Daily Podcast for the 31st of May. I'm your host, Paul White. Today you're listening to the DDP Essay Edition for May 2018. This month, I want to use our essay as an actual scriptural examination. Beyond a sermon or lesson breakdown, I want to look at how a particular verse is used almost universally in the church, out of the church, by saint and sinner alike. It is embraced by people who use it to defend the defenseless and by those who defend the indefensible. It's a verse that's propped up one moment and completely ignored the next, depending on what or who one is defending or attacking. The verse is John 8:7, and it comes in the story of the woman caught in the act of adultery. When the crowd presses Jesus as to whether or not he thinks the woman should be stoned for her sin, which is what Moses commands in the law, he gives his famous reply, "He who is without sin among you, let him throw a stone at her first," or as it is more commonly quoted, "He that is without sin, cast the first stone." The concept of this Jesus principle has been reimagined in our culture as people that live in glass houses shouldn't throw rocks. Well, in either form, the idea is the same. Fallen, sinful, fractured people should refrain from hurling judgment and condemnation at others because in the end, who are you? What qualifies you to judge someone else, and who would dare do so, knowing that finding dirt in our own lives is so easy for someone else to do? Well, perhaps the first stop on our journey to understanding this verse is to consider the context of the event and to determine exactly what Jesus was challenging the group to do. You heard that right. Jesus was not ordering them not to throw stones, but offering them the opportunity to do exactly that. He tells them to cast the stone, but to make sure they qualify as stone throwers. The reader realizes that only Jesus has the right to actually throw the stone because only Jesus is sinless, and yet even he makes no move to pick up a rock. And what exactly does Jesus mean by cast the first stone? Well, the group of men that have assembled to accuse the woman have based their judgment call on Leviticus 20 and 10, in which both the adulterer and the adulteress are to be stoned if they're caught committing adultery. Strangely, the group didn't bring the man or even mention him, so we can assume they have either already dealt with him separately, doubtful, or they have set this woman up in order to use her as a way of trapping Jesus. In any event, and perhaps we are best to make few assumptions, Jesus' statement about casting the first stone is an invitation to actually kill her with rocks by hitting her in the head with them. He isn't warning them against making verbal accusations or against looking into the law and making proper judgments. Simply, he is showing them that actually picking up a sharp rock and breaking open a woman's skull with it should be thought out with more care than they are showing. And that if we were to be honest with ourselves in that moment, we might find that we have neither the right nor the inclination to actually commit that murder. When we quote this verse for a multitude of purposes, we rarely, if ever, use it to warn people away from killing someone. We misapply it in regards to its contextual use, in that we assume words or accusations are the same thing as stoning someone. Well, personally, I would rather have someone say bad things about me, make false accusations, or verbally berate me than to crack my skull open with a rock, but perhaps that's just me. Of course, I understand that proper biblical hermeneutics allow for allegory, metaphor, and application outside of the immediate context. When Jesus instructed his audience to carry a load 2 miles when ordered to carry only a mile, we know that he was referring to the literal Roman military ordering citizens into labor for brief spans, and that in order to show the power of the kingdom, believers should be willing to go 2 miles. However, there's also a deeper application that crosses space and time and speaks into our lives, that we are conduits of the kingdom in the world today, and that when we are put upon, we should respond not with rebellion and violence, but with the heart of a servant. That application worked on them, and it works on us, even though no one is ordering us to carry a load a mile. Well, in that sense, cast the first stone works as an injunction against hurling verbal jabs and accusations, but it doesn't remain effective only as long as you want it to. In other words, we don't have the right to use a verse when we need it and then ignore it when it doesn't fit our situation or our sensibilities. For example, John 8:7 is often used by people who want to defend an ideology or a doctrine or their favorite hero minister or ministry. When someone questions their ideology, their doctrine, or their minister, they respond with, "He without sin cast the first stone." This is a popular defense mechanism of those who defend a fallen minister when people show distrust toward that ministry due to past failure. It's as if the instruction to stop casting stones should cover any and all accusations. And again, who am I to say it shouldn't? However, it seems improper for the same group to then attack any doctrine that doesn't agree with their own, or any ideology that questions their theology, or any minister who falls in a manner they think is different from the fall of their own hero. In short, some of the same people who defend their situation by telling others not to throw stones spend most of their time sharpening rocks to toss at anything outside their circle. Use the verse back on these groups, they'll simply find another verse like, "I'm just judging a righteous judgment," or, "The truth will make you free." It's remarkable how we can find precisely what we need from Scripture when Scripture becomes a book full of arguments instead of a book full of Jesus. Another stop on the journey to understanding this verse may come by stating the difference between what is good and what is right. The two are not always the same thing. A constitutional scholar might argue that it was illegal for Abraham Lincoln to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. The Constitution allowed slavery and gave no space to a sitting president to issue an executive order outlawing the practice. Legally, what he did may have been wrong, but it's nearly impossible to argue that slavery was right, and it's definitely impossible to argue that it was good. Is doing the wrong thing sometimes the same as doing the good thing? Jesus seemed to think so. In Matthew 12, the Pharisees accused Jesus' disciples of doing what was wrong on the Sabbath. But Jesus tells the story of David eating the showbread out of the temple, which was not lawful for him to do. And this is an interesting precedent that Jesus lays out. David is wrong for eating the bread, but it would have been evil for him to have fasted from that bread when his body so badly needed the nourishment as he was running from King Saul. His wrong trumped the evil. His wrongdoing may not have been the right thing, but it was the good thing. Jesus seems to give us this lesson in vivid color in the John 8 story of the adulterous woman. It is right for them to stone her. The law allows and even demands it. But it is evil for them to do so. For who are they? What is right in this scenario is not what is good. Learning the difference in right and wrong is not the glory of the believer, though it is unfortunately how we often learn and most always how we teach our children. Instead, the New Testament way seems to be learning to discern the difference between good and evil. Right and wrong often change across time and between cultures, but good and evil have a universal application and appeal. Maybe the final takeaway is that we should leave the job of exposure and judgment to Jesus. The judge and the mediator are on the same mountain we are on in Hebrews 12, so he seems capable of handling it. Admittedly, we are instructed by Paul in 1 Corinthians 5 not to associate with believers who continue in habitual sin. Now, there's a lot to be unpacked in that instruction, but the basis seems to involve those whose sins are so egregious that they are bringing shame to the church as a whole. In that context, it seems like pretty good advice if you care at all for the health of the body at large. But even in this, Paul seems to soften later. When in 2 Corinthians 2, he stated that the punishment inflicted by the majority was sufficient, and that taking it any farther would be to swallow the offender, and I quote, with too much sorrow. Well, I can't speak for Paul's frame of mind, but I think he's saying, it's right for us to put this one out of our midst, but time has taught me that it may not be good. Remember, they are not always the same thing. Grace to you.